Welcome to Deconstructing Yourself, the podcast for modern mutants interested in meditation, awakening, Vajrayana, non-dual Shaiva Tantra, consciousness hacking, emptiness, direct path teachings, and lots more. My name is Michael Taft, your host on the podcast, and in this episode I'm speaking once again with Chandra Easton. Chandra Easton has taught meditation and yoga since 2001. She's had the good fortune to study with many Tibetan and Western Buddhist teachers, such as His Holiness the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Karmapa, Lama Sultram Alioni, B. Alan Wallace, and Jennifer Wellwood, among many others. She is currently the Assistant Spiritual Director and Head Teacher at the Tara Mandala Retreat Center. Chandra has published several books, including her new book, Embodying Tara, 21 Manifestations to Awaken Your Innate Wisdom. And now I give you the episode that I call Embodying the 21 Taras with Chandra Easton. Chandra, welcome back to the Deconstructing Yourself podcast.
It's so nice to be here with you again, Michael. Thank you.
Maybe I'm mistaken, but I believe this is your fourth appearance on the show. You're absolutely favorite guest, so thanks for being willing to come back on and be pelted with questions yet again.
Well, you're a great podcaster and you're a great friend, so it's my pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. So you have given birth recently to an amazing project, an amazing book, as I hold in my hands right now, this very beautiful, nice, thick, heavy book from Shambhala Publishing called Embodying Tara. So congratulations on this work, Chandra.
Thank you.
Now, this is very unusual, I would say, because most people who are familiar with, let's say, Vajrayana iconography or Tibetan Buddhist iconography, probably going to know Green Tara. That's a pretty famous, shall we say, well-known bodhisattva or Buddha out there, right? There's lots of people know about Green Tara. You go to a retreat center like Vajrapani, there's a huge tanka of Green Tara there. That image is everywhere, at least in the Vajrayana world. But this idea that there are actually 21 Taras, which is what this book Embodying Tara is about, right? The subtitle is 21 Manifestations to Awaken Your Innate Wisdom. The idea that there's kind of like 21 facets of Tara, that I think is quite unusual. At least I haven't seen it around that often. Sometimes we hear maybe about five basic Taras, like white and green and red and so on, but 21, that's unusual. Let's back up, and I'd love to know, first of all, like how you got into Tara, and then furthermore, how you came upon like this much richer, deeper, more elaborate mandala, you know, circle of 21 Taras.
Yeah, it's true, especially in the Western Buddhist world or even non-Buddhist Western world, many people will recognize Green Tara Tankas. She is certainly the most popular one. And growing up, I was fortunate to have a mother who was devoted to Tara. And so the first mantra I ever learned as a young girl was to Tara. And Green Tara mantra is the classic 10-syllable mantra of Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Svaha. And yet that mantra can be used and applied and chanted for any of the Taras. However, she's mostly the Green Taras associated with that mantra. So I grew up with the feeling of devotion and protection and like motherly love, really, to Green Tara streaming through my mom. So I feel really grateful to her for that. And
so you've literally been worshiping Tara your whole life.
I wouldn't use the word worship. It's a funny word, isn't it? But yes. I mean, why not? She's definitely deserves to be worshipped and worthy of worship. But feeling love for her and from her, yes. And chanting her mantra, yes, certainly. Yeah. My mom became a devoted Buddhist practitioner even before I was born. Her and my father got into Zen Buddhism. And then when I was young, like little baby, maybe 1, 2, 3 years old, she started studying in earnest with Chogyam Trungpa in Boulder, Colorado. But then when she met His Holiness the 16th Karmapa, who Trungpa had invited to the West, she just felt, okay, here's my teacher. So she took refuge with the 16th Karmapa, and I was with her as a young child around, I think, the age of 4. So I am told by her that I took refuge with her at that time. I don't have a clear memory of that per se. I have other memories of the great 16th Karmapa, but the volition from my own side to take refuge is not very clear in my memory. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if people know, but one of the hallmarks of being Buddhist is by taking refuge in the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So that is how I was first introduced to her. And all along, I sort of knew about the 21 Thadas a little bit as I got older, because I think I've seen Tankas, or within the Tibetan Buddhist communities, they are well known, because the praises to the 21 Thadas, which is a very famous dharani, or it's called a tantra, like a text, but also it's called a long mantra, or dharani, which is the word for a long mantra text, like the Heart Sutra or the Ushnishavijaya Sutra. There are these longer prayers that are considered to be, you can recite them or should recite them like a mantra. And some of them take, you know, 3, 5, 10 minutes to recite. So the 21 praises to Tara is a famous tantric dharani that came out of the 11th and 12th centuries in medieval India and became popular in Tibet about 100 years later. And so children at a very young age learn this text, whether they're monastic, young monastics, or children living in nomadic tents in eastern Tibet. They grow up learning this and memorizing it and chanting it every day, often in the morning and in the evening, with morning and evening prayers with the family.
And is the idea that chanting this is going to bring protection and healing and blessings and so on?
Yeah, blessings, calling on the blessings of all the 21 Thadas. So my point is that basically this is really well known within Himalayan Buddhism, within Tibetan Buddhism, but not so well known within Western Buddhist circles. So you're right. A lot of people know about green or white or red Thada, but not many know about the 21 Thadas. There's the golden Thada, there's blue-black Thada, there's fierce Thadas, semi-fierce Thadas, and peaceful Thadas. And so that is in part why I wrote this book. You had also asked how I came to know them. Well, more intimately, I came to know them through one of my teachers, Lama Tsoltra Malioni, who founded Tara Mandala in southwest Colorado, Pagosa Springs, Colorado. And she devoted the whole temple to the 21 Taras. In fact, it's called the Trikaya, which means the three body, or the three, you know, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, the Trikaya temple to Tara. And the inner sanctum is lined with 21 statues, about half life-size statues that are consecrated, blessed, kind of empowered. So it's like in spirit, it's like they're alive. These 21 Thadas line the inner sanctum of this beautiful temple. So when I was feeling into some different ideas of a book to write, because I felt like it was time to do that, I asked her for guidance, and she suggested that I help to bring the 21 Thadas alive, because they can sometimes feel quite distant or arcane. And that's what I did. It felt like, of course, you know, yes, I can do that. I will try to do that with joy. It's been a great project. I learned so much. It was hard, you know, it wasn't all joyful. It wasn't all love and light, but you know, about 5 years total of my life was devoted to, the first like 3 years was to, devoted to research and writing my proposal and crafting the skeleton of the book. And then the last 2 years was the actual writing. And I feel so good. It's so nice to hold it in my hand and to get emails or texts from friends or students or talk to people in class and hear how it's affecting them. It's such a joy. I knew that might happen, but this feeling I've been getting is like the candle flame being lit from one candle, lit to the next, with that flame to the next. It's like Tara's blessings are ignited in the hearts of the various people who read and get inspired by this book. I always remember it's not about me, it's about the Taras. It's about channeling their blessings and helping modern day people open to that possibility and feel her all around them and within them. I mean, it's called embodying Tara. So it's about that. How do we embody her enlightened activities for this time of such deep need and crisis in our world?
It's so beautiful. I have some questions just about how this is understood. So I'm curious, I know Tara is sometimes a bodhisattva and sometimes a Buddha, depending on which tradition you're in. But how do we hold the understanding of 21 Taras? Are these 21 separate Buddhas, or is it one Buddha that has 21 emanations? Like, how is it understood? That we have 21, but they're all still Tara.
Right. Well, let's start with her name. Tara literally means the savioress. So it's that the goddess or the female Buddha who saves. So from her compassionate heart, she is available to save beings. And so Tara literally means to save, or she is the she who saves. And
that was a surprise, because I, in my mind, I always translated it as star.
Well, that's what I'm getting to, is some different texts say different things. So Tara, her proper name that means to save, or the savioress, she who saves, has two long A's, right? Tara, instead of Tara. So if you take the long vowel A off and it's just Tara, that could mean star. I've seen it flipped too, depending on the source. So it depends. But if with a slight change in the spelling, and not even really with the spelling, it's just, do you hold the A for two counts or for one count?
Yes.
It changes the meaning and it means star. And so the commentaries, the texts say she's infinite in number, like the stars in the sky. So there aren't even just 21, let alone one. And I love that, because yes, it's like, you know, the heart sings with that. Like, of course, there's as many Taras as there are atoms, you know, or, you know, specks of dust or grains of sand on the earth and stars in the sky. But then for conventions, for some reason, in the 12th century India, medieval India, this Tantra arose through visions. It's said that the Buddha appeared to Suryagupta, a great Mahasiddha in Tantric Buddhist history, Suryagupta, and revealed these 21 praises to the Buddha Tara. So you're right on by saying, what is this? Is it 21 different deities or 21 aspects of one deity? I would say the latter. The praises we're celebrating, like a lot of the Hindu tantric hymns to the goddess, like the Chandipat or Devi Mahatmya, which sings the various divine names of the goddess, right? So it's a similar feeling. The text itself starts with the first 21 praises are sung celebrating 21 different aspects or ways that the goddess Tara appears to beings in service of beings. And then the last few stanzas talk about how to practice the Tantra and her benefits and so on. And so over time, through convention and I think through human nature, those 21 stanzas that were celebrating the different facets of the one source of luminosity that is the Buddha Tara became articulated as paintings and statues and iconographically, like through art, kind of reinforced a perception that they are 21 different beings. And then who's to say that that actually in some way didn't become true? You know, I don't know. I'm not going to venture to say that that's not the case. But the original intent, what I learned through my research, is that the 21 praises sing the praises to Tara, the goddess Tara, the Buddha Tara, in 21 different ways. And then later that became kind of almost reified or solidified through different traditions representing her in different ways. So you have three main different iconographic traditions, which I talk about in my book. You have the Suryagupta, which is the first one, and many of those Taras are drawn and sculpted and maybe even perceived, seen through mystical visions, as having multiple arms, multiple faces, different accoutrements in each hand. Some are standing, some are seated. A lot of variety in that tradition. And that's primarily practiced within the Sakya tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, Sakya. And then, but not exclusively to that tradition alone. And then you have another one that is associated with Atisha, the great Mahayana teacher who brought the Lojong teachings to Tibet in the 11th century. He was a huge devotee of Tara, and he's actually attributed to bringing the devotional potency and power to Tara that exists today in Tibet. It's like it caught like wildfire from his heart, from his devotion to Tara, and spread throughout Tibet and continues within Tibetan Buddhism to this day. And so his tradition shows various different colors, so the positions are the same and the symbols are different on each of their lotus flowers. Then the third tradition that my book is based on is the Terma, or the treasure cycle of the great treasure revealer or Tertön named Jigme Lingpa. And he lived in 1700s. So in mystical visions, while he was in retreat in a cave in Tibet, 3-year retreat he was doing, he received many mystical visions where he revealed enormous amounts of texts and practices called the Longchen Nyingtig cycle, which means the heart essence of the vast expanse.
Yeah, I'm used to reading his Revelations of the Ever-Present Good, which is a wonderful text. I had no idea that he had this Tara cycle as well.
That's another thing a lot of us didn't know, is that within the cycle of those revelations, those termas, he also had visions of Tara and the 21 Taras, where he also downloaded these mantras that you'll find in the book also that are associated with this cycle. It's called the Queen of Great Bliss cycle of Dechen Gyalmo in Tibetan. And that is an amazing practice in and of itself. At Taramandala, we do these long prayer retreat, cycle retreat ceremonies where we take 8 or 10 days to really go deep with each of the Taras found in this cycle of the Queen of Great Bliss from Jigme Lingpa. And the iconography of the Jigme Lingpa cycle of the 21 Taras is very similar to the Atisha ones, but different colors because, or different symbols that they're holding on their lotus flowers, different expressions. Why? Because the praises themselves don't always give that information. I mean, sometimes it'll say, oh, she's brilliantly white, like a 10,000 autumn full moons, right? Sometimes a praise will indicate the mood, the color, or the power of each Tara. But a lot of it is left up to the imagination. And that's why you have these three main different iconographic traditions.
So cool and so rich that we can dig in so many different ways. So in your book, you're using the Jigme Lingpa images, correct?
That's right, because that's the tradition I've learned and we hold at Taramandala. And the really wonderful teacher, Kenpo Tsewang Dungyal Rinpoche, who co-wrote with his wonderful brother who's deceased, Kenchen Palden Sherab, they are like the OGs is what I call them, the OGs, original gangsters. Such a funny image to me, but they're like the OGs of this Nyingma cycle of the 21 Taras from Jigme Lingpa. They wrote wonderful books one is called Taras Enlightened Activities.
Oh yeah, I have that book.
Yeah. And the earlier one is called The Smile of Sun and Moon. It's their commentary, really Kenchen Palden Sherab's commentary to Jigme Lingpa's commentary to the praises to the 21 Taras.
Now, there's something interesting you're doing here. There's several really unique features in this book, just besides its depth and erudition. There's some really interesting stuff. One is, you're talking about, as is common in Vajrayana, that there's different levels at which you can engage with this material. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, four different levels.
Yeah. So this, the four-level analysis or method of understanding a practice or a text is not just applied to this particular text. It's a common way of understanding teachings and texts. It's called the Tsulji. Tsulji. Tsul means method, and Ji means four. And Khenchen Palden Sherab Rinpoche and his brother Khenpo Tsewang Dungyal Rinpoche, who I consulted with extensively on this project, by the way, and I'm so grateful to Khenpo Rinpoche's immense generosity and bodhicitta compassion and passion for Tara. So they talk about these four methods in their book. So I chose to really take that further, not further, but highlight that also in my work, because some are quite advanced. The latter two are advanced, and the former two levels are more accessible and appropriate for the discussion in my book. And here's why. Okay, so the first level is like the meaning, like the word for word meaning, like literally, like what do these words mean, right? So we can apply that to any text. What is the definition of this word, that word, and what does it mean? And then the second level is the deeper meaning, like the implication of practice in our psyche, in our, for our spiritual growth and evolution. And that provides the foundation of understanding her symbolic meaning, really, and how it affects our mind, our heart, and how we can apply the words and then the symbolic meaning to our practice through sadhana, through deity yoga, to be explicit. And I do talk about what is deity yoga in the introduction as well, and why would we even do it, you know, and why are there deities in Buddhism? If Buddha claimed there was no God, then why are we talking about deity yoga? That's something maybe we could talk about too. But the first two levels help us understand the meaning on the outer level and the inner level, and what implication does that have for our practice and our embodiment of Tara, so that we can help make this world a better place, just like Tara, through, you know, compassion and wisdom and loving kindness and joy. So the latter two are really enticing and fun. And I almost want to be sacrilege and say the word sexy, because it's where a lot of my interest is too. But you really need to receive those latter two levels of meaning teachings from a qualified lama who is qualified to give them. But I, of course, I can explain what they are, which is, you'll find this in, especially in the Tara's Enlightened Activity book, as well as in The Smile of Sun and Moon, those two texts I mentioned earlier. And the latter two levels of meaning refer to the stanzas, each stanza of the praises to the 21 Taras, and how they can be understood from a yogic perspective. Like when the color white is talked about in Tantra, and especially in Mahayoga, and where we do like the Tsalung and Chokor practices, white has a certain connotation. It refers to the enlightened essence, masculine energy within our bodies. And that's like the Amrita that drips from the crown chakra down through the central channel, right? And the color red, on the other hand, refers to the enlightened feminine aspect within our subtle body, which lives at the hara, you know, at the navel center, is associated with fire. And so through understanding on a more subtle level the meaning of the words on a more yogic perspective, you're engaging in the 21 Taras praises through that third level of Tsalung Trokor practices, or the Tibetan yogas. And you would need lots of commentary to even understand how to do that. And I actually asked Khenpo Rinpoche, or Khenpo Tsewang Dungyal Rinpoche, so I call him Khenpo Rinpoche for short, how can I learn more about this? Because I'm a yogi, I love yoga, I've taught yoga for many years, I am very passionate about that aspect of practice. And he said, well, there aren't really explicit, like, commentaries or retreats you can do. It's just a lens through which you can understand how to work with the essence drops, you know, which are the bindu, the prana, which is the energy that runs through the channels, and of course the channels, it's the nadi. It's ways of understanding that and how to balance those energies and those essence drops into our central channel, the Shushumna or Avaduti, and abide in the bliss of Samadhi. So I said, well, can we talk about that some more? He said, oh, I don't know that much about it. Yeah, maybe we could talk about it. He was very humble and kind of deferred away from it. You know, so hopefully when the karmas are ripe, those teachings can be revealed and I can learn them and people can learn them. Then the fourth level of the tsulji, of the four methods, is referring to the advanced practices of Dzogchen, or the great perfection, or Ati Yoga is a Sanskrit word for Dzogchen. Also, people might know Mahasandhi is another way in Sanskrit to talk about Dzogchen. So those advanced practices in the great perfection, Dzogchen, are called Trekche, which means breaking through or to break through, and then Tugel, which is the leap over phases of really basically breaking through duality and conventional reality and the substrate consciousness, to be quite frank, into Rigpa, into pristine awareness, or, you know, primordial consciousness is another way of saying that, and then abiding in that and resting in it, stabilizing in it, and actually achieving rainbow body through Tugel, which is working with the five lights and five wisdoms and purifying perception. Those are very advanced practices that I've only gotten a little bit of teachings on. I'm very, you know, modest around that. I don't teach that. And again, I asked Kempo Rinpoche about that, and he said, again, the 21 praises to the Tathas, each stanza can be understood as lenses through which to understand how we work those two phases of Dzogchen through Trekche and Tugel. So I do not go into those latter two phases in my book because I felt like, as a Westerner, as a humble, like Patra Rinpoche calls himself, an old dog, kind of a dense, thick-skulled Western human being with a lot of veils who doesn't understand very much about Dharma at all, I thought I would just focus on the safe places of the first two levels and try to juice it up as much as possible, because I think a lot of us are there, right? That's where we're at, really. You have to do lots of retreat and practice and extensive study and be very humble and sit at the feet of qualified teachers to get the nectar of those latter two phases. And I know a lot of us have done that. But in a book like mine, what felt more interesting or more appropriate would be to really make it so those first two levels are very understandable and accessible to Westerners, even non-Buddhists, people who are interested in spirituality or women's studies or iconography and Buddhist art, can enjoy and learn and connect with the Tathas in that way, and then do deity yoga, which is, again, within the realm of that second level of understanding of symbolic meaning, and recite mantra and enjoy kind of flirting with the latter two phases, you know, build the foundation for that development later on.
Yeah, thank you for unpacking that. And that reflects back on some of these really beautiful unveilings or embellishments that you've done on those levels. For example, obviously very unique to you, thing that you have done here is included like regular figures from the mundane world as examples of Tara's, I guess you would say, enlightened activity in the world, which I think that's a very bold thing to do. I mean, you want to talk about what you were thinking there and why Oprah Winfrey's in here as an example of a Tara?
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know what I did? And my dear friend, our friend, Eve Ekman, who's fabulous. She's such a Dharma sister for me. Yeah, I was talking to her about this project and bouncing some things off of her because we talk a lot about our work together and we've taught a lot together. And she said, you know what you should do? You should teach this curriculum to people first, and then transcribe your teachings and let that be the basis of your book. And I said, brilliant, that's exactly what I'll do. So I did that. And I did it for 2 years. I did 2 1-year long immersions. So we went deliberately through each of the Taras and explored them, meditated on them. And then I found that gave me time to find different real life women and movements, even founded by women or women identified folks who were embodying these enlightened qualities of the Taras. And I also was able to, through my classes, ask people, okay, here's the woman I'm bringing forth as, you know, Saraswati Tara or Demolition Tara. We'll talk about later. I know we want to talk about her in Tara 13, Droma Yule Gyalje Ma. But who do you think fits the bill? Who would you recommend? So I actually kind of crowdsourced with my students their suggestions for real life women and movements who embody her enlightened activities. And it helped me refine and develop these ways of thinking further and make it better. So in my acknowledgments, I thank everybody for that. It was really fun to do it that way. And it does feel a little gutsy because it's like, come on, because it could be a little cheesy, right? So instead of it being cheesy, what I'm hearing from people all along is that it is infinitely helpful way for people to see Tara in the world, in their lives, and in themselves. And so someone like, okay, why Oprah Winfrey? You said, well, we could talk about that one. That's the 11th Tara. And she's about abundance. She is about prosperity, both spiritual and material wealth. And Oprah Winfrey is the greatest American philanthropist of all time, or at least in the writing of the book. And she is so generous with the money that she's made and the abundant spirit she has towards especially helping women and girls in all around the world, but in Africa, that it was just so, I had to use her, you know. Whereas other Taras, I got to really bring forth women I had never heard about, suggestions from people I know or other students. And then I had this really fun, joyful adventure of researching and diving deeply into the lives of women I had never heard about before. Like Nawal El-Sadawi, Egyptian poet, playwright, author, feminist, psychiatrist, who fought for the gender equality in Egypt and fought against female genital mutilation. And her story is very compelling. She is my modern day, I always get her mixed up, 6th Tara, I think. You know, after a while, sometimes they blend into each other. But she's one of those first fierce Taras. Yeah, she's the 6th. I was right. Nawal El-Sadawi, amazing Egyptian feminist, humanitarian, and writer, educator. She died, unfortunately, in 2021, right when I discovered her, like 3 months later, she passed away during COVID. I don't know if she died of COVID. I don't think she did. But so it was a real joy finding ways to creatively tie these lives into the Taras, and it helped me a lot, and I think it helps other people too.
Yeah, and so is the idea that these real-life embodied figures, let's say mundane figures, searching for the right word here, are intended to show the mood of this Tara as enacted by someone that is perhaps more relatable, or are you pointing at something maybe even deeper here?
That's such a great question. I feel like maybe the best way to answer that is to go right into a specific example of a Tara and then the real life woman who I chose for that particular Tara. So I had mentioned the 13th Tara earlier, and she's a very interesting one. Her name in English is Tara, who is victorious over war. And the Tibetan is Drolma Yule Gyalje Ma. Sanskrit is Tara Ripu Chakra Vinashini. And so in the book, I shorten her name. I often use the Sanskrit because I love the Sanskrit language. And so I like to focus on their names in Sanskrit. Because her name is so long, I shorten it to Tara Vinashini. And Vinashini can be translated as like to demolish or to destroy. And so I nicknamed this Tara Demolition Tara. I thought that was kind of fun. So we can call her that a little bit. Yeah. She's very powerful. She's semi-fierce and red in color. So some of the Tathas are 100% fierce, some are 100% peaceful, and some are half and half. And so she's one of them that has both. Now, in some renditions, she's also considered to be completely fierce. So it depends on your source text. In any case, she is victorious over war. And we've been praying to this particular Tata a lot at Taramandala ever since the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And we've done, by this point, maybe over by now, probably 10 million mantra recitations globally. We ask people to practice on their own or in groups and together recite the mantras and then send in their mantra counts. And we have people who are tallying them at Taramandala. And this is all meant to have momentum and build the power of the blessings together collectively to, in some way, try to help in situations where we often feel completely powerless. And this by no means implies that we shouldn't also do things to help beings, right? But also sometimes spiritually it's good to pray. And sometimes that's all we can do.
Yes.
And so this particular Tata not only is the demolition Tata for outer danger, right? Because that's what she does. She's victorious over war per se. But she's also helps to demolish, for lack of a better word, our inner obstacles, obscurations, or what are called the two veils, which are the emotional obscurations of the five poisons of ignorance, aversion, conceit, clinging, and jealousy, right? These classic five kleshas. And then also our cognitive obscurations, which is more of like the way we think about the world and ourselves and how that can be obscured. And that is namely reifying self and phenomena as being intrinsically existent. So when we pacify these inner two veils in our personal life, our personal practice, the teachings say that we can arrive naturally without effort at the threshold of liberation. That's called awakening. We become a Buddha. We become Buddha Tara. And so there's so much. So this chapter, I'm in chapter 13, talking about the 13th Tara on page 167 of the book. And I go through her mantra, what her meaning is on a deeper level, what her symbol is atop her lotus flower, which is an open-pronged vajra, which is very interesting. Vajra is like a ritual scepter, you could call it. This symbolizes the adamantine, indestructible nature of mind that we all have within us, our Buddha nature. It's also an expression of the enlightened masculine energy and compassion. But often the vajra is shown with a closed or tapered prongs on either side. It's hard to describe without showing you a picture of it, but it's like there's a central ball and then five spokes on either end. It's like a ritual scepter. So usually those are tapered, but this Tata's symbol is an open-pronged vajra. And when we do her meditation practice, we imagine, when we're reciting her mantra, we imagine that this open-pronged vajra emanates out countless tiny vajras, multiplying and sparkling in all different directions. So it's like fireworks. And these vajras form what's called an indestructible protective tent of rainbow-colored double vajras, like a luminous net around areas in danger and need, safeguarding beings from war and aggression and so on. And of course, we can also feel that as our personal protection against ourselves, you could say, our afflictive emotions and all of those things that cause us internal harm too. But these double vajras that make almost like a chain link rainbow fence around us, if that image helps you kind of see these double vajras creating like a net of rainbow light around places in need. And that also represents stability. Double vajras represent a stability of the Buddha nature within all of us. Okay, so wow, that's a lot, right? Like, who is this Tara? And how could I find a real life woman or movement that embodies this Tara Vinashini, demolition Tara's capacity to liberate beings from suffering in the sense of protecting them from war and aggression, both inner and outer. So I was looking around and I had a list of a bunch of different options of different people and maybe movements even that could fall within this category of embodying this particular Tara's power or enlightened activity. And the one I landed on was a woman who's still alive. Her name is Zainab Salbi. She was born in Iraq in 1969. She's an Iraqi-American humanitarian writer and public speaker. And Zainab has committed most of her life to helping people ravaged by war. So in this way, like Demolition Tara or Tara Vinashini, Zainab Salbi has helped to shed light on the suffering of war, but also what Zainab did is emphasize the untold side of war, namely how war affects women, children, and families in ways that often have gone unseen and unaddressed by governments and mainstream media. It's better now, but back in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, it was a lot different for those of us who are a bit older. We know how the way media covers war and the way governments address the fallout of war, for better or for worse, you know, has changed in some ways and more revealing of the untold side of war. In any case, Zainab Salbi was very important in bringing awareness to that. She founded an organization called Women for Women International. It's a grassroots humanitarian organization dedicated to serving women survivors of war by offering support and tools and access to life-changing skills that help these women move from crisis and poverty to stability and economic self-sufficiency. So I tell her story about how she came to that. And one of the aspects of her life was that she, as a young child, she grew up in Baghdad during the Iran-Iraq war. And during the bombing raids in Baghdad, her mother would sing to her and her siblings and do puppet shows to them. They were young children, to try to create some semblance of normalcy and stability for her family. And through this music and puppet stories, what I saw in one way was that this was a mother's desperate way to create a rainbow protective tent woven by a mother's love for her children.
Oh, interesting.
Over them, right? So that was one way that I felt that that came into alignment with Tara Vinashini. Yeah. In another way was that when Zainab Salbi founded Women for Women International, it was really born from a moment in time when she heard about the horrors of the rape camps during the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina that occurred from 1992 to 1995. That was the impetus for her to create this organization, Women for Women International. And what her vision was and what she went about doing was helping to create a sister-to-sister network, like links in the Vajra chain, right? The Vajra network of hearts holding each other between sponsors, people maybe like me who was hearing about a woman or a family suffering in a certain part of the world and wanted to help, but I didn't know how to help. So she created this sister-to-sister connection, like a rainbow Vajra tent, between sponsors in the United States and other parts of the world, and women survivors of that particular war. And then it became a larger global movement. So that gives you an example of what I'm trying to do with these real-life examples, is to help us see ways that Tara's energy can come alive within us, within our work and service in the world, and then to also see it all around us in creative ways in other people's work and lives. And in some way, help us to keep putting one foot in front of the other when things start feeling so desolate. That's one example.
What an inspired vision. Right? I mean, that's really quite interesting. It brings it down to earth in a positive sense, like grounds the whole thing in actual people and real actions we can take in the world, Even in your further contemplation part after these figures, you talk about how the reader can perhaps bring some of this energy into their life. It's very cool.
And then at the end of that, after further contemplations, then we get to sit down and meditate on her and embody her and chant her mantra and envision these blessings going out, if, you know, filling the world in some way. So I hope that this book uplifts people. I feel like for me, my experience was in writing this, that it was uplifting, but in the most grounded way. Like, I'm reading about horrible things. I'm experiencing in real life things that are so challenging. And yet in the midst of it, we can help in some way. And we can get inspired by hearing stories of normal women, normal people, but also extraordinary people as well. I also later in the book start getting into movements. Like, I talk about the Me Too movement and how that is embodying that particular Tara's power, which is quite similar to the 13th Tara, actually, in the sense where that particular Tara protects beings from invading forces, meaning harm that comes in from the outside into us, like sexual abuse, let alone violence. And so the Me Too movement is a movement that seeks to build empathy and safety and more justice for survivors of sexual abuse, and not just women. Yeah.
Yeah. So not only individuals, but also movements that embody these qualities. And you do have very detailed sadhanas for each of the Taras. That's amazing. But given the time here, I want to leap to the back of the book where you have another unique thing. This is after the 21 Taras and all their sadhanas. You have a feature called Journey with Tara. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you could describe what that's about.
Yeah, that was inspired by Journey with the Dakinis that Lama Tsultram developed in her mandala work. And I loved that personal process called Journey with the Dakinis so much. And I worked with people around that and saw how beneficial, in a sense, more modern way of doing a journey with a particular energy or guide or ally or protector that then you can ask questions to and answer from their perspective, not unlike feeding your demons, actually. So if people have done feeding your demons, this journey work is very similar to that. And so I asked Lama Tsultram, can I adapt your Journey with the Dakini to the Taras? And she said, yes. So I give credit to her in that section and adapted it so that you can go on a journey with any of these Taras. And it's quite a wonderful thing to do. You see where they take you. Why do they take you to this certain environment? And then you can ask questions of that particular Tara. And instead of just waiting for the answer as if it's coming from some, you know, real god or goddess or deity out there, you then switch positions and you take the form, you become that Tara. And you answer your own questions from the vantage point of the enlightened Tara, or as enlightened as you can possibly feel in the moment, you know, from that energy of embodying Tara with her brilliance and her symbolism and all that. Speaking from that perspective, it's like tapping in to your deeper wisdom nature and answering those questions from that perspective. And then coming back to your original seed. If you have follow-up questions, you can go back and forth as many times as you like, switching positions each time and becoming the deity Tara and then answering as her. And there's other thing, then she gives you a gift, and it's a really rich practice that I encourage people to utilize either after you do a sadhana. So maybe you are working with 13th Tara and you're doing her sadhana that's at the end of her chapter. And from time to time, if you're feeling blockages around her energy, maybe, or you're having heartbreak or despair or whatever blockage or lack of clarity you might be experiencing that might be tied with the particular Tara's wisdom or power or compassion, then you can go on a journey with that Tara after a sadhana or even as a standalone practice.
And so the word journey here is being used in the sense of like shamanic journey or active imagination journey. right?
Yes.
We're going to go in and do a kind of visionary journey.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow. So cool. Well, I'm feeling all sad because we have to end here.
I know. I kind of want to take you all on a journey.
Yeah.
That would be fun. And people can do that either in the book on their own, or also there's an audiobook. And I'm talking to folks who have shared with me that they actually like to have the book because you have the pictures and you can hold it in your hands and read it slowly. And then also getting the audiobook, which I read.
Oh, good.
Then they can listen and be guided in the meditations and also in the journey. So it's nice in a way to have. I wish they kind of did like a package so you'd get a discount to get both the hard copy and the audio. But I recommend people do that.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I can't imagine anyone else reading it, given that you have to pronounce the Sanskrit mantras and the Tibetan mantras and go through the whole thing.
Oh, believe me, I had to fight to get them to let me do it. They wanted to hire somebody. I said, the whole book would be a completely different book if you have some, you know, someone read it who doesn't know Tibetan or Sanskrit. It'd be embarrassing.
Right? Yeah, it just wouldn't work. No. Well, okay. So if people want to be guided on a journey, I guess get the audiobook of this amazing text. And as I say, just the physical copy, paper copy, is quite an object. And it's by Shambhala Press, so it has these fabulous drawings of the Taras and so on. So that's my plug for your book, which I think is just amazing. We did in earlier sessions on deconstructing yourself, Chandra. I don't know if you recall, but you led us through Tara deity yoga sadhana before. So that's just what one of my favorite episodes where you actually do that. So if people want to see what that's like to be led by Chandra in that, there are earlier episodes where we do that. And then, of course, I'm sure that's there on the audiobook as well. So, okay. Thank you so much, Chandra. It's a real pleasure. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Michael. It was a pleasure for me too.
That's it for this episode of Deconstructing Yourself. I'd like to let you know about an upcoming retreat I have available in the first half of 2024. This April, I'll be teaching a 6-day residential retreat at Mount Madonna Center in the hills of Northern California. From April 14th to the 19th, I'll be leading practitioners in non-dual meditation techniques, guided meditations, and silent sitting with the group. So if you'd like to spend 6 days working on deepening your spiritual practice, and particularly working on your non-dual meditation with me and a group of interested folks, please consider joining me at Mount Madonna this April. Just go to the deconstructingyourself.com/events page and follow the links you find there. I look forward to seeing you at the retreat. There will also be a meditation retreat with me coming up this August in Costa Rica. You can find out more about that at the same deconstructingyourself.com/events page. If you enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to a friend or talk about it on social media. Doing that helps it find its way to more people who might be interested. If you're moved to support the podcast, you can do that by contributing to the production costs on my Patreon page. That's at patreon.com/MichaelTaft. The money goes to support the recording, production, and bandwidth costs of this program, which are substantial. By contributing to Patreon, you're making it possible for me to continue to create and share these conversations as often as possible. A special perk for high-level contributors is a monthly or even bi-monthly event with me on Zoom, where you can ask me any meditation questions you have. I deeply appreciate your support. I also have a number of free resources for you, beginning with my YouTube channel. There are hundreds of hours of free guided meditations and videos there. So if you're interested, that's quite a large resource and offered to you completely free of charge. The channel address on YouTube is MWT111, or you can just search my name, Michael Taft. I encourage you to subscribe to the channel and join me each week for a new live guided meditation session. If you'd like to interact with a broad community of people interested in meditation, particularly those who engage with my YouTube meditations, I have a free Discord server called Deconstruct You. That's deconstruct and then just the single capital letter U. There are a large number of discussion channels there, and it's free, so hop on the server and introduce yourself. And of course, there's the deconstructingyourself.com website itself, which has articles, interviews, and more about meditation going back over 12 years at this point. So be sure to check that out. Beyond these free options, I also have a number of paid online courses to help you grow and develop in your spiritual practice. You can find out about those either by signing up for my email list at deconstructingyourself.com/signup or at the site deconstructingyourself.org. I look forward to seeing you in class. The Deconstructing Yourself podcast has always had excellent sound, which is the result of an amazing audio engineer and amazing human being named Stephen McNamara. He's an all things audio person with many decades of experience in producing music and spoken word audio. If you're interested, you can contact him at his website, yogitar.com. That's yogitar.com. Music on the Deconstructing Yourself podcast is a track by Peter Bauman entitled Crossing the Abyss from his album Machines of Desire. Thank you for listening.